Star Wars. Nothing but Star Wars. Give me the Star Wars. Don't let them end.
You know, I think I've told this story on mic, on various mics, several times over the years, but when I was talking on the phone with Adam West that one time,
right,
when we were back at the Varsity, I believe you were in the office.
I was disappointed to learn that the interview was not being conducted for the Varsity. You were merely using company resources. Very inappropriate.
Yeah, that is correct. You can take it away from my barely existent pay. I asked him about working with the Three Stooges because he was in their last feature film from the Curly Joe Derita era. And he said, and I remember it almost word for word, "Like any actors worth their salt, they saved it for the camera." In person, they were very quiet, kept to themselves. They'd be happy to talk to you, but for the most part, saved their energy until the cameras started rolling and it was bop, bonk, slap. So, you know, from one great actor to another, three.
I mean, that's like you and I. We're basically monks, like, outside of this. We save it all.
I live a very ascetic lifestyle. I'm like a Paul Schrader film in real life. Yeah, just an empty room, me writing my diary.
Yeah, between podcasts, I'm just like up in the foothills of Kilimanjaro in the lotus position, you know, in between, like saving all my energy for when we go see the fucking, you know, Ben Affleck Nike movie or whatever we're doing.
And I come back and we have a full staff of interns and people chained to the trending topics to say, okay, what should we talk about at the beginning of an episode? Back in the day, they would also check like Jay Leno's monologue jokes and, you know, try to reword them. And then we would say them. That's just a peek into the Michael and Us writer's room.
Well, I don't know how to transition into this, but I would.
Welcome to Michael and Us, by the way. I'm Earl Sloan.
Welcome back to Michael and Us. I'm Luke Savage, as always. Would you believe it, Will, if I said that friend of the show, Joe Lieberman, he's at it again?
Has he had a political conversion? Have we swung him to the left at the age of 89 whatever old he is?
I got to be careful here because, you know, he does own half of the Gore Lieberman studios. Yeah. And, you know, in theory, we have editorial independence. So we're playing with fire here. But no, I wrote earlier this week about the group No Labels, which he, and, you know, I'm sure you know about them because you're like, you're against labels. You're on record as being opposed to labels.
Well, a slight digression, but other friend of the show, Frank D'Angelo, was running for mayor of Toronto. That's the energy drink mogul and restaurateur and sometimes filmmaker. And I saw that in his press release, he said he was running as an independent, you know, to none of the special interests of the left or the right, which is funny because in Toronto mayoral politics, you do run as an independent. You are actually not. Yeah,
there's no parties.
You're not. I mean, obviously, we all know that they're partisan in one way or another, but it's not a special feature to be an independent. Anyway, you're telling me that Joe Lieberman is, you know, a man who has made his bones being an independent, a man who has always been forward, not left nor right. It's going further forward.
That's right. Yeah. You know, everyone will remember Lieberman as Al Gore's vice presidential nominee.
Because Al Gore was a little bit too far. Part of the left already. Yeah, you know, the member of the Democratic Leadership Council. God,
the radicalism out of Al Gore had to be tempered with a dash of moderation, and that's where Joe Lieberman came along. And as we all know, it was a wild success. Al Gore lost his own home state. To be fair, he did win the popular vote, and they did win the election. It was stolen, but the fact that it was close at all, absolutely pathetic, terrible ticket, disastrous. Fun fact about Joe Lieberman is he has the singular distinction, I think, of being the only person in American history to almost, I mean, he didn't quite do it. Even Joe Lieberman's not that great. But to almost be on the ticket for both parties, because John McCain nearly picked him. This was the, you know, the famous, like, Marcos Militsis, like, they primaried Joe Lieberman, right? And they beat him in the primary. He lost the Democratic nomination. The plucky upstarts from Netroots Nation, they beat Joe Lieberman. And then he just, like, kicked their ass
as an independent
and, you know, stayed in as an independent. So anyway, Lieberman's still around. And there's this group, No Labels. They fund something that's called the Problem Solvers Caucus in the House.
Well, who could be against that?
Yeah, people like solving problems. The solutions are always like, wow, we should add a work requirement to like food stamps or whatever, it's that kind of shit. It's like stuff that was like kind of right wing even in the 1990s. Now, fun fact about this group, No Labels, and I'll explain why I'm talking about this in a second. They were founded in 2010, and it's crazy. If you go back to the press coverage at the time, so much of it just regurgitates their own kind of, the way they frame themselves. It's like a new group in Washington wants to transcend the partisan divide. Now, Frank Rich, who we discussed on the show a few weeks ago in the Balloon Boy episode, to his credit, he wrote shortly after No Labels launched, "This is exactly the kind of revolving door synergy between corporate power and governance that turns off Americans left, right, and yes, center. What America needs is not another political organization with a toothless agenda and less than transparent finances." So, Rich was perceptive there because, of course, over the years, there's been more and more reporting on where this organization gets its money. And it's just like this rogues gallery of like, people that they courted when they launched. Not all these people donated, but just like to give you a sense of like who they were trying to get donations from. David Koch, Hank Greenberg, the former head of AIG, Peter Thiel, Ken Langone, the founder of Home Depot. Michael Bloomberg was an early supporter. He was at some of their events. And basically the politics of this group are sort of Bloombergism, where it's like, it's like right-leaning liberalism, where it's like just very paternalistic, New York liberal, and like very friendly with finance capital and, just kind of obsessed with the idea that if you slap an eye onto something, that makes it transgressive. But like to give you an example of like just how non-grassroots this would-be grassroots group is, in the 2018 election cycle, its vast federation of super PACs raised $11 million from just about 50 donors. And the average donation was $124,000. So these are not salt of the earth types. Oh, and by the way, there was a listener who sent me a Washington. I was following the story already, but the act of them sending me the Washington Post story about this was the prod I needed to write about it. Now, what the Washington Post broke last week or reported on was that No Labels has actually budgeted $70 million to get on the presidential ballot in all 50 states. Now, this does not mean they are actually going to run a ticket. And, Lieberman is pretty coy in the piece. Like he's quoted as sort of saying like, well, we're going to take our moderate, sensible, middle of the road agenda to both parties and see if, if they'll listen, then maybe we'll do an endorsement. But I guess the implicit threat is like they will literally run a sort of like Lieberman mansion is very favorable to this project as well. Kyrsten Sinema as well. It's all people like that. And so, the implication is they may back a candidate like that, which I think would be very, very funny because people would get very indignant about like, oh, you're going to hand the election to Trump or, you're going to hand the election to the Republican candidate who's going to be Trump, obviously. But I mean, I personally think they should go for it. I think that, the lesson is clear from Jeb Bush and also from Michael Bloomberg himself, an early proponent of No Labels. When No Labels launched, there was a lot of speculation that it was basically just a sort of like racket. Well, it is a racket, but there was a speculation that it was a racket to just get set up a Michael Bloomberg independent presidential run. And, it may have been that. But both Jeb Bush and Michael Bloomberg, I think, show that there are limits in politics to what money can buy. Obviously, they ran on mainstream party tickets. But nonetheless, I think, in the case of Bloomberg, he just like turned on like a tap of money. And, he won a couple delegates in American Samoa. It really showed that you actually can't entirely astroturf a campaign. There has to be some kind of popular appeal, at least if you're still going to go through this whole business of elections.
I mean, ever since Ralph Nader, it's been kind of a boogeyman among American liberals that like, oh, this third party candidate is going to come in and, siphon off 1,000 votes in every key swing state that, hand the election over to Trump. Gary Johnson and Jill Stein in 2016. For a while, Kanye was making some bids to be that archetype. I guess Jill Stein is still much hated by much of the commentariat, but these bids never really seem to amount to anything, do they?
Well, Nader, he did get something like 90,000 votes in Florida in 2000. And, in the case of Gary Johnson, it's funny, like when, I remember in like a thing you'd see in like early 2017 was like a certain type of lib doing these posts where they would like add Jill Stein and Gary Johnson's votes, like, to Hillary Clinton's, like, as if, like, oh, if you don't have third-party people, they vote for Hillary. And it's like, well, no, a lot of these people probably would have stayed home. The act of just, like, attaching, like, all the weird, like, libertarians who voted to Gary Johnson to Hillary Clinton is, like, very strange. And if anything, Gary Johnson probably handed her two states. I mean, Ralph Nader got votes because what he was saying was popular. People liked it. But, yeah, I mean, I don't think people should be, you know, people should not be too anxious about this. I mean, even if they do it, I just think you get two, like, you get a Joe Lieberman, a Joe Manchin or something like that. They team up. I mean, I think the kind of working theory is that what they would do is they'd have, like, one Democrat and one Republican. So, like, you'd get, like, a, I don't know, like, I don't know if Lieberman would, he's like a free space, I guess, if he ran.
So. Have you ever seen a little movie called My Fellow Americans? Because it ends in a similar way. Or a little movie called Speechless.
Yeah. So I guess this is sort of the fever dream. This is channeling the fever dream of, like, you know, a fucking Liz Cheney, I don't know, who would the Democrat, Liz Cheney, Joe Manchin, or, like, that kind of ticket or something. And yeah, I just don't think that has appeal. And, like, you could get a bunch of Wall Street freaks to throw, like, $400 million behind it. I personally think it would have limited success, and it might even polarize parts of the electorate harder in favor of the Democratic candidate, because there'd be such a backlash, because people would be so angry about this. Look, we'll move on from No Labels in a second, but I have just one more thing to share with you, Will. Would you believe that in 2010, when they launched, they commissioned an anthem from Akon? So this is the No Labels anthem.
Something to believe. I'm only one man with a voice. That's something we got in common. Need a model with a look at me. He's a Democrat, he's Republican. There's a fight in the race, who's gonna win? Put your differences aside, man, if you can. Cause there's way too many people suffering. I wish they didn't have no
It's good. I like it.
It goes on and on and on.
And dance to it. Good schools. Don't want them in a juvenile facilities. Or growing up with mental disabilities. When all this time you could have made a difference, but you decided to roll with the party. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I mean, it just kind of goes on like that. What I like is the comments, which, as far as I can tell, are all, like, incredibly earnest. It's just like, this is 2 years ago. I feel like this song is way more relevant now than when it came out. Akon is a legend, still bumping his tunes, his voice. 2022, I'm still listening this old song. I love this song. This is my label, that I love you from my true heart. So isn't that sweet? Well, Will, I have one more discussion item before we get to our main subject for the week.
Well, I'm glad to hear, because I came unprepared, so please.
This is Van Jones.
He looks sad.
Yeah.
He looks sad. He looks like the weight of it's hitting him. And, you know, just as a human being, like, I don't take joy. I don't like the prison system. I don't like what it does to people. I don't like this process. So I don't take any celebration in seeing him looking that way. He looks sad. Now, doesn't mean that accountability is not owed. We don't know what he's going to be charged with. There's a lot more. But at that moment, that is not a conqueror. That is a granddad having a very bad day.
So that, in case you couldn't figure out, was Van Jones reacting to Donald Trump's arrest. Your reaction, Will?
Well, you know, a warrior respects a warrior, even if he's his enemy.
So I gotta say, that is the worst thing I've seen all week. I hate that. I hate it so much. Here you have, right, this should be like the Super Bowl for liberals. This should be their Woodstock. It's like, take a fucking victory lap. This is what your side has wanted for years and years.
But if you don't have moral superiority, if you don't have self-righteousness,
that's right.
Then what do you have?
Right. So, like, the fact that Van Jones feels the need to do this kind of like, oh, well, in this moment, he's not a conqueror. He became a granddad in that moment. It's like just the utter joylessness of that, but then also just like the smugness, like he has to, like, I mean, forgive me, but he has to virtue signal in this moment. He, like, liberals, even in this moment, some of them, it seems, can't, like, embrace the id. Like, their politics are all super ego, so they have to do these lachrymose, like, well, accountability is important, but I don't like the prison system. It's like, god damn it, Trump is in chains, just enjoy it. This is them reacting as Trump is being arrested. God, just unforgivably joyless. God damn it, I hate it.
Well, speaking of joyless, George Lucas, last week on the Patreon episode, we tossed around the idea of discussing the Star Wars prequels. We put it to you, the listeners, you know, join us in this conversation. And we got a mixed response. Some were on your side, some were on my side.
People don't like labels.
We're
creating a third party ticket.
Yes, we found a third way. We have found a way to discuss the Star Wars prequels by instead discussing Damon Packard's 2003 film, The Untitled Star Wars Mockumentary.
Action!
We can't do it for your budget.
CGI rules. CGI rules. Go digital, go. Digital characters rule. Digital characters rule.
Someone bought me an espresso, and I must say,
I think it'd be simply wonderful.
That's great.
It's gonna be great.
That's gonna be great.
It's gonna be great.
That's gonna be great.
That's gonna be great.
Fuck me the fuck, bitch!
So we are going to talk about some Star Wars shit, but Will, I feel like this one probably needs a certain amount of setup. So can you put the film in context and the director in context?
Well, this is directed by a fellow by the name of Damon Packard, who's a Los Angeles-based underground filmmaker. He's been a hero to mine because he keeps making movies that simply cannot be legally distributed. His most famous is a grand term to use, but probably his key work is one called Reflections of Evil from 2002, which I would pitch it as like Inland Empire meets Bum Fights. It is a
sold.
It is a 2.5-hour movie starring him as an alien type creature who appears as a homeless man, and it's following him around on the streets of Los Angeles as he throws up, makes faces, picks fights with people, surrounded by the dream factory all around him. Billboards for Miss Congeniality above him. There are strange dream sequences where he encounters the young Steven Spielberg on the Universal backlot. He's a filmmaker who is a true guerrilla visionary. Very funny as well. I don't know if Tim and Eric ever saw him, but he could be perceived as a sort of proto-Tim and Eric.
Very Tim and Eric, yeah.
The way he uses heavily copyrighted footage an intellectual property with complete abandon. And I mean, Reflections of Evil, which is both almost unendurable and a masterpiece, my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, it is this kind of like primal scream at this incredibly cruel and unjust world that's also saying, well, we at least got to laugh about it. He's made other films since then. His most ambitious film is called Fatal Pulse, which is, you know, much slicker than that film, but also probably cannot be legally distributed. Also has strong Inland Empire vibes. And this film, Untitled Star Wars Mockumentary, is probably one of his more accessible films. You can find it online. It's uploaded on YouTube. You can also find files floating around. It's this kind of mashup collage film that he made, the prime source material being the behind-the-scenes documentary footage from the DVDs of Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, and Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones. Now, if you've seen, you know, the old Mr. Plinkett reviews on Red Letter Media, you know, if you've been on the internet in the last 20 years and your tastes lean towards the geeky, you're probably familiar with some of that footage of George Lucas making these movies at Industrial Light and Magic.
Oh, it's incredible.
You know, he's been insulated. He's been in George world for a while. That footage sometimes comes across as real life The Office.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't see it in this film, but, you know, the classic, it's like poetry and rhyme.
Yeah.
Or, you know, after they screen the first rough cut of Phantom Menace, and, you know, you see him and his yes men and lackeys.
Literally, these amazing shots from all that footage of, like, they'll watch something, it'll cut, like, just momentarily to the faces of, like, the people that are watching, and they're just, like, you get...
It's as if they were at a funeral.
Yeah, just these hints of, like, horror, and they're all trying to do these poker faces, and there's the famous scene, which does appear in this movie, where George Lucas is sort of saying, like, they've just finished watching Attack of the Clones or something, and the first rough cut, and he's like,
seems like a lot of short scenes.
It's bold in terms of jerking people around, but I may have gone too far in a few places.
Untitled Star Wars mockumentary, really, I mean, it won my heart. Packard himself won my heart. This was the first film of his I saw. In its opening seconds, when he uses, I'm just going to go on a little digression here. Back in the early 2000s, there was a DVD company called Delta Laserlight that released a bunch of public domain classic movies on very shitty looking DVDs called Laserlight Special Edition Classics.
The business model here is there's certain classic movies that are in the public domain, and what this company figured out how to do is just, like, we'll package them and we'll sell them.
Yeah,
and they had a sort of cheap aesthetic and cheaply made.
But what they did get was the actor Tony Curtis, quite washed up at this point, to introduce them. And, you know, if you've ever seen one of those DVDs, you'll know that he was reading from the teleprompter, often quite clumsily, wearing all white, but also these bizarre black gloves that made it look like he was about to strangle someone. And he'd say, "Hi, I'm Tony Curtis. Welcome to Laserlight Special Edition Classics. Today, we're talking about Orson Welles and one of his great films, Mr. Arkadin. Have you ever seen a shooting star? Phew, that was awesome." You know, the hackiest intros. And it opens with one of those intros of Tony Curtis saying, "Hi, I'm Tony Curtis. Today, we're talking about Damon Packard."
"Hi, I'm Tony Curtis. Welcome to Laserlight Special Edition Classics. In this program, you're going to see Damon Packard's movie in 1981 called Cabo Blanco. It also stars
Sean Yanez,
an excellent actor. Story takes place in South America, right after World War II. All the characters are searching for a huge treasure of Nazi gold. If I'd been there, I would have searched for it myself."
This, to me, announces the Packard aesthetic of, first of all, demolishing all hierarchies in audiovisual entertainment and melting the entire history of film into one big paste in this, I think, quite political way. In this film, he takes George Lucas and Star Wars, the crown jewel of intellectual property, one of the richest entertainers in the world, and immediately mashes it together with, you know, washed up Tony Curtis introducing these public domain films. And then there's this intro in the mashup aesthetic where, you know, he takes a trailer for a long forgotten movie called They Call Me Mr. Tibbs, which was the sequel to In the Heat of the Night. And Packard mashes footage of himself into that trailer, as well as footage of lots of other different kinds of movies, and puts it all into this one big soup, as if to say, like, Star Wars might be Star Wars, but it's still film history. And most of film history is kind of tacky.
Right.
And you know what? Star Wars is kind of tacky, too.
Well, and it's also about, like, you know, he's pulling a lot of footage from films that were cheap. And what's funny about mashing that together with, like, something like Attack of the Clones is that, I mean, one thing you can't say about it is that it's cheap. It's incredibly expensive. But that doesn't mean that it's not, like, tacky.
Yes.
And I mean, that's what this kind of collage effect really achieves, is it renders in a kind of very hyper-real way. I mean, very similar to a film we discussed last week, Bring Me the Head of Tim Horton, the camp that's buried. Well, it's not even buried. Just the camp that's found in a movie like Star Wars Attack of the Clones.
So if Star Wars Attack of the Clones was notable for anything, it's that I think it was the first commercial, theatrically released movie that was, like, a 100% digital film. It was not shot on any 35 millimeter film. film. It was, you know, in some theaters, it was exhibited on digital. I mean, it's basically an animated film.
I mean, we should stop and talk about this for a second, because I think this is one of the reasons why that movie was so bad. And I think it's, well, I don't know. I know there's been this attempt to sort of, yeah, reclaim the prequels or whatever. But I think even among people who have some kind of, you know, quasi-ironic love for the prequels now that they've rediscovered, I think most people would probably agree that the second one is the worst one.
It's funny. Watching Untitled Star Wars Mockumentary, it has a lot of footage from Attack of the Clones. And I haven't seen Attack of the Clones in forever. And, you know, the passage of time has rendered these images, like, I mean, they look in some ways more interesting than they did 20 years ago. But you kind of have to jump through a lot of hoops, and you have to like recontextualize it in your mind to make it successful. Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, look, there's so much about that movie that doesn't work, and we should talk about that movie and why it's bad for a second. I mean, several of the actors in that movie have said that, like, I mean, I think it was of Attack of the Clones, maybe it was just of the prequels in general, where Natalie Portman said, like, you know, these movies, like nearly convinced everybody that I couldn't act at all, you know? And I know a number of the actors have complained that, you know, if the acting in these movies is so, like, weird and stilted, what you got to understand is we had nothing to work with. It's like, we can't see anything. Like, they just sort of tell us, oh yeah, you're in a big, like, you're on a spaceship, you're in a spaceport, whatever. But they're literally just on a soundstage with, like, a green screen. And the artificiality of it really comes through when you see the sequences in this movie where they're doing, like, the lightsaber duels and stuff. Like, there's a really funny sequence where Christopher Lee is filming, like, the worst lightsaber fight of all time, which is the one where between Count Dooku and Yoda.
And it's so funny to see the behind-the-scenes footage without the CGI, where it's Christopher Lee just, like, twirling this sword in what looks like a laser tag facility.
Yeah, but, you know, Attack of the Clones, it also just, like, does have too much going on it. There's too many disparate elements. Like, there's this love story between Hayden Christensen and Natalie Portman, which, you know, I think the two give it the old college try, but I don't think the chemistry is there. It doesn't really make sense, because, like, the tension in it is supposed to be that, like, Anakin is supposed to be Volsel as, like, a Jedi. But then, like, for some reason, his mission, they're like, don't you be having sex with Padme now, which also doesn't make any sense. The age difference doesn't make any sense, because, like, she hasn't aged since the first one. He's supposed to be, like, I don't know.
How old was she in the first one? Like, if she was 16 and he was 11, you know, that's kind of the most generous reading you can give it.
I feel like it's supposed to be a bigger age gap. I don't know. It doesn't really matter. That's not the problem with this movie. But regardless, like, Obi-Wan Kenobi and, like, Yoda and Mace Windu were like, don't you be having sex with Padme now, like, all Jedi are celibate. And
I think they were fucking with them. I think they just put them in a room together said, watch this.
Then, having said that, they're like, okay, and your mission is to go to the most romantic, to go to a villa on Naboo surrounded by waterfalls. You know, Natalie Portman is just, like, wearing these, like, ridiculous outfits, and he's just, like, flirting with her constantly, and they're just, like, rolling around in the hills with these big wildebeests and stuff. Completely ridiculous. And then there's this whole other plot where Ewan McGregor is, like, George Lucas, I guess, it was trying to do this noir thing. Like, you probably remember the really weird diner scene.
Well, it was kind of like a 50s diner in space, wasn't it? I don't really care for George Lucas, but he was more interesting than J.J. Abrams is, because, like, George Lucas will give you a fucking insane idea, like a 50s diner in space.
Well, that right there is why I think people have tried to, like, reclaim the prequels.
Yes.
And I accept the spirit of that to a point, because you're absolutely right. It is more interesting to see one man's megalomania and, like, insularity produce this just, like, completely insane thing that doesn't work and is very expensive.
And some of the images we see in this film of that movie are just, like, such eyesores, so
ugly,
such bizarre digital vistas.
Uh-huh. And you get to see, like, the process by which some of this stuff came about. So, like, one of the many things this movie does is it ruins Coruscant, right? Coruscant is, you know, this is like the...
What's Coruscant?
It's later the Imperial capital. It's like the capital of the Republic. And, you know, the whole point of Coruscant is that the planet is just, like, one big... It's like a mega city planet, you know? It's like the galactic metropole. And, like, I don't know, Lucas just, like, over-imagines it so much. Like, there are these lanes of traffic in the sky and stuff like that. And so there's that early scene where Anakin and Obi-Wan are in the speeder and, like, chasing a bounty hunter or something. And Obi-Wan ends up, like, hanging from another speeder or something. And we see in the Star Wars Untitled Mockumentary them discussing, like, how, like, an alien... They need to add a new alien that's gonna, like, speed past Obi-Wan and, like, you know, nearly hit him or something. something. And it's like, these are just the kind of dumbass idea. It's like, the screen is already so dense. There's already so much going on. And George Lucas is like, what if we had another alien and it nearly hits Obi-Wan Kenobi? And this is the kind of shit that they're expending energy on. And then like a few minutes after that, you know, it's supposed to be the same planet. And then they're in a sort of like weird, like cyberpunk bar where, yeah, the guy's trying to sell them death sticks or whatever. Just nothing about the movie works. It's all these kind of disparate elements smashed together. There's the whole like Kamino outing, which we only got to see a little bit of in the mockumentary, where the aliens just have those really long necks. And there's an example of something that's like another big problem with the prequels, which, you know, this is obviously by no means a novel observation, but just the way that they have to shoehorn in absolutely everything. Like, nothing can just be, everything has to be prehistory to things you've seen already. So you get the revelation that, well, if you remember Boba Fett, now you get to see him as a kid, and his dad was, he had Boba Fett, who's a Jango Fett, and guess what? All the stormtroopers are modeled on him. So all the stormtroopers are Boba Fett.
See,
amazing.
More than anything else in the world, more than any of the political causes that Luke claims to care about, this is the subject that animates him. The Star Wars prequels, the Star Wars sequels, nothing gets him more passionate with. I think these movies really hurt you when you watched them growing up, and the newer ones hurt you now. And, you know, to me, these movies are just movies I don't like.
Fundamentally, that's what they are to me as well.
Yeah.
I think actually, in order to kind of explain the difference between our reactions, like when we have the same reaction, but yours is just more emotionally ambivalent than mine.
I feel like your reaction, though, is closer to Mr. Damon Packard's, because my sense watching this movie is that he's a fan.
Yes, I was going to advance that thesis, but let me just finish the point before we come back to the mockumentary. I mean, I think the real difference between us on this is that I actually do still kind of like the original Star Wars movies. I mean, I really liked them as a kid, and I stopped watching them for like, 20 years. I mean, I don't even think I've seen either of the latter two. I think I watched A New Hope when I was like extremely high on opioids after my operation in 2021. But I don't think I've seen Empire Strikes Back or Return of the Jedi for like 15 or 20 years. So I've kind of kept them as these like kind of cherished nostalgia objects where if I'm in a particular kind of mood with like, I don't know, 15 year intervals, I can watch them and still have a good time.
All right, Luke, you and me, I've got a bootleg Blu-ray that has a scan of a 35 millimeter theatrical print of The Empire Strikes Back from the time.
Wow.
It's scratchy. This is the version you should watch. I've seen it, and it's spectacular. You get to see what the movie looked like before 25 years, 30, how, fuck, 40 years of digital.
It's a long
time. It's 40
time.
Now. Yeah. 40 years of digital enhancements and airbrushings were made to make this movie look modern.
This is one of those things where we could probably, you know, we could probably create one of those statistics like about, like, you know, the one about like more time has passed between like now and the airing of that 70s show than like was between the 70s, and it's like
more time has passed between now and, you know, Empire Strikes Back than Empire Strikes Back and Casablanca.
Something like that. Yeah.
But yeah, I would surmise that Packard is a fan of not only Star Wars but also pretty much the whole sci-fi and fantasy genre. There are clips throughout the movie, you know, shots of the original theatrical trailers of A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, and those images are quite bracing because, first of all, the trailers, you know, there's been so many efforts over the years to spruce up those Star Wars films, make them look modern, the special editions with their enhanced special effects. Mm-hmm. And those trailers are so of the time. You know, they've got the trailer guy voice. They've got the graphics are so of the 1970s. And you see the footage in those trailers that it's so tactile, so tangible, the way the sets looked, the way the puppets looked. And those are placed strategically throughout this in contrast to the kind of textureless digital dreamscapes of the
I'm glad that's your reading of it, because that was my reading too, is that he was putting in that kind of earlier footage as a deliberate point of contrast to make what, I mean, I guess by now, 20 years on from when this film was made, is hopefully kind of self-evident to people, but like, just pumping money into special effects does not a good movie make. Films have only grown more and more artificial since Attack Attack of the Clones. And frankly, Attack of the Clones was sort of one of the Trojan horses that brought us towards, you know, the sorry state that we're currently in. Like, you can say, okay, the prequels are, you know, one madman realizing his dream, and you can like it or dislike it, but, you know, it's better than J.J. Abrams. And it's like, maybe that's true. But the fact is, George Lucas paved the way for J.J. Abrams, okay? Attack of the Clones is a proto J.J. Abrams film, and I don't care.
Them's fighting words.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
People will be upset.
Yeah, put them up, folks. Queensberry rules.
You know, no, I gotta object to that. I mean, George Lucas, with his advancements in digital technology and just, you know, creating the first Star Wars in 1977, is the father of a lot of what's wrong with culture. But but you look at the J.J. Abrams Star Wars, and they're perfect AI simulations of a Star Wars movie where they're like, okay, you don't like the CGI? We got puppets again. We got sets. Ugh. You don't like the shit about trade routes and I don't like sand and all that fucking bullshit? Well, we got a movie that's exactly the same plot as A New Hope. Ugh. And it's soulless. It's God. Dead inside. So, I mean, Attack of the Clones, The Force Awakens, they're two very different unsuccessful visions.
I agree with that. I just think that one follows the other.
Well, I mean, they're both Star Wars movies. Anyway, Untitled Star Wars Mockumentary, like I say, it's a sort of collage film, but there is a kind of story that runs through it. You follow the making of a Star Wars movie. The footage of George Lucas is, well, barely manipulated to make him look like a kind of a clueless and out-of-touch boss. The footage itself is interspliced with newly shot scenes of Packard and several of his friends and fellow actors playing, you know, hapless Lucasfilm employees, you know, making notes at some of his bizarre directions. There's a moment where, like, Packard, who's, you know, a sort of unidentified employee at the company, is like leading a prayer circle. CGI is great. CGI is great. CGI is great. There are various scenes where they screen rough cut footage and special effects demonstrations where, you know, Lucas and company will be in a screening room, and on the screen they'll see stuff that's like 50% footage of Attack of the Clones and then 50% footage of just random other stuff, whether it's Conan the Barbarian or The Sword and the Sorcerer, or like there's one bit where it's Star Wars and then it's like a lot of stuff from The Exorcist, you know, the most obscene and startling scenes from The Exorcist. There are also, you know, satiric jabs at the whole Lucas project all the way through. So, like, some of the more shocking and potentially offensive moments in the movie are, there's a bit where, you know, a Lucasfilm technician is adding post-synchronized sound to a scene from a Star Wars ostensibly a scene from a Star Wars movie, and it's hardcore pornography. And you just see hardcore pornography.
Yeah, and then he's sort of going, boy, we just need one more. We need to take one more for safety.
Yeah.
And they just do it again.
There's a very brutal and ugly satiric moment that I won't fully describe, but it's taking aim at Lucas's, let's say, problematic treatment of race. And, you know, when you watch this movie, like, you'll probably be shocked at this moment, but it's some real take-no-prisoners satire from Packard.
Yeah, it's just like a riff on how the Star Wars movies draw on, like, the basest racial stereotypes imaginable.
Just pure minstrelsy.
Oh, my God. I mean, like, look, not to get into another Star Wars digression here, but it's like, I did watch The Phantom Menace again a few years ago, and it's like, you could not make a movie like that today, okay? Like, what the fuck is the...
Watto. I mean, Watto.
Watto is unreal. Like, okay. Mind tricks no work on me, only money.
Yeah, I mean, he's practically out of Der Sturmer.
There's like, fucking the planet of Naboo. It's like, there doesn't seem to be anyone living. Like, the people of Naboo, that Queen Natalie Portman, who's somehow an elected queen, doesn't make any sense. She's governing this planet. It seems to be basically one town. Everyone who lives there is like a cop or a security person or like a fighter pilot. Or just some kind of like robed aristocrat. And then the vast majority of the planet is just like the Gungans who live underwater, who are clearly just like some kind of like colonized indigenous people and are just made to be like literally dumb as hell. And then in the final like third of the movie, they just convince the Gungans to just basically run at the Trade Federation's tanks and they all get slaughtered. And then at the end, they give them a big shiny ball and the boss Nass hoists it up in the air and cheers. And then the movie ends. Yeah, there's a lot of race science going on in that movie and in the other ones.
I mean, what do we know about George Lucas? We know that he famously grew up loving old adventure serials, old movies, jungle adventure movies, you know, B-movies from the 30s and 40s, stuff like that. And then, you know, he got so rich and so insulated that nobody was there to tell him, like, you know, you can't just bring these stereotypes. You know, you can't have Mantan Moreland in your fucking movie in 2000.
Guy's like, you know, he's so fucking complacent. I mean, you know, he has no fucking idea what's going on in the world. He just lives up in some fucking isolation, like some feudal baron, you know, like cut off from the human race. I mean, you know, no wonder these movies are so fucking antiseptic, you know.
Untitled Star Wars mockumentary climaxes with footage of, you know, the opening day of either The Phantom Menace or Attack of the Clones, one of those two. You know, the line around the block, the people who have camped out for weeks, people with all their Star Wars merch almost crying as they go in. By the way, did I see The Force Awakens with you?
Oh, yeah. You and I have seen, I think...
How many have we seen together?
I think we've seen at least three in theaters. We saw The Force Awakens, we saw Rogue One,
That's right.
We saw The Rise of Skywalker. And in our defense, The Rise of Skywalker was for this podcast. We saw The Last Jedi.
I would have seen it.
We saw The Last Jedi.
Separately, I believe.
Yeah, it was for our very first Patreon episode, but it wasn't in theaters.
Because I remember seeing The Force Awakens, and that movie had such a huge buildup. I mean, God, even me, not much of a Star Wars fan, when that trailer came out that had Han Solo and Chewbacca in it, you know, Chewie, we're home. God, even me felt a little twinge of like... Aw. And then I've been punished with a decade of just nonstop Star Wars content, you know, coming out of every orifice of the culture since.
Yeah, they made the whole internet out of the Star Wars.
Yeah. And yeah, I just remember at that screen, you know, like electricity in the air, every seat packed. I remember one guy running up the aisle like, I can't believe I'm going to finally see it.
Yeah.
And it felt pretty exciting. It felt like being part of something. But anyway, the footage in Untitled Star Wars mockumentary, you know, you see all the fans in, and then Packard superimposes on the screen footage from Ken Russell's Women in Love.
It was just two guys like naked wrestling each other, but everyone in the audience is cheering and like waving lightsabers in the air.
And I mean, in addition to like being extremely funny, to have the Star Wars audience like screaming at like a woman taking off her top, and like, you know, footage from the trailer of Women in Love is shocking, and if audiences can't accept the shock, it's their loss, says the Telegraph, you know, like... I think there's a sort of satiric point to, like, you know, both the utter sexlessness of the George Lucas Star Wars saga, which is a point that's brought up several times in Untitled Star Wars mockumentary, as well as, like, am I projecting too much onto this scene to suggest that there's, like, a kind of road not taken in this? Like, yeah, they have made the whole culture out of the geek culture since then. And, like, just the idea of people cheering on and, like, lining up around the block for a sort of boundary-pushing early 70s erotic drama for adults is, like, very funny and also a little melancholy.
I think all of my favorite moments in this movie... involve George Lucas or people on his team workshopping like little bits of Attack of the Clones, and you can really see like why it was so bad. That scene where George Lucas is seeing sort of a rough cut of CGI Yoda say "Begun the Clone War has," and he doesn't think that they've sort of captured like the right, like George Lucas is like really like overthinking what Yoda's like shitty CGI Yoda's facial expression is going to be, and he's like in the most inarticulate way possible trying to explain it. Or some of the soundstage scenes where they're just listening to lightsaber noises, and he's like, it should be less zoom 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 and more like like just the dumbest, most kind of like megalomaniac thing imaginable, but also like so hilariously camp, because in the original footage that you're seeing, which was part of some kind of, you know, behind the scenes featurette or something, clearly the intention is to be like, look, George Lucas is a genius, like look at him thinking through all this stuff, it's easy, his dreams are so big, these movies are these Promethean achievements of a man who's like too big for this earth, too great. And then, yeah, meanwhile, he's just going zoom, zoom, zoom. There's a little epilogue in Star Wars Untitled mockumentary, which is basically just the scene from the beginning of Apocalypse Now, where they're playing Martin Sheen's character, the tape of Colonel Kurtz, you know, who's gone mad in the on the fringes of the jungle. This works very well for many reasons, among them because Harrison Ford just happens to be in that scene and have a minor part in Apocalypse Now. But yeah, of course, all the audio of Kurtz is just George Lucas, like, saying stupid George Lucas things. Like in the first scene, it's like a monologue about how, like, well, I always get what I want. And then in the second one, he appears to be musing again on the subject of Yoda. And he's like, I just wonder about his ears.
You heard of Colonel George Lucas?
Yes, sir, I've heard the name.
October 9, 0430 hours, Sector Peter Victor King.
These are monitored out of Lucas Valley.
The digital characters are what I need really to tell the Star Wars films, so I could have a story that was more like the one that I could think of in my head. Very rarely do I not get what I want. It occurred to me that it may be wise for us to build Dooku as a computer character too.
So this is a very funny film, but I also like what it represents. I mean, we've heard for so many years from our corporate overlords about how, you know, superhero movies, Star Wars, stuff like this, this is the new folklore. These are our new myths.
This is our Homer.
You know, that's what they like to say. There are collective myths. And the thing about collective myths is you're supposed to be able to, like, tell them. You're supposed to be able to partake in them. They're supposed to belong to all of us.
Yeah, right.
You know?
And try sitting down and explaining what the plot of Attack of the Clones is. I challenge you.
Well, Star Wars is something that is obviously extremely meaningful to so many people. It was, you know, the movie that millions of people watched with their dads, or, you know, lined up around the block to see, you know, have very consequential memories with it. And it's part of the fabric of millions of people's lives. It's deeply meaningful to people. But, like, as of 2003, George Lucas owns it. And today, as of today, the Disney company owns it. And the Disney company is now the company that's in charge of propagating the idea that, well, this is our collective folklore, and therefore it's your duty to watch season 2 of Andor coming soon, or whatever, so that you can be part of the collective folklore. But, of course, you know, you can never do your own Star Wars thing. And in this, it's this kind of foolhardy and I think admirable attempt by Packard to sort of almost like reclaim Star Wars on behalf of the audience. He's saying, like, George Lucas is a crazy man who's lost touch with reality, and he has no idea what's good anymore, and he controls this. And fuck it, I'm going to make my own Star Wars movie. I'm gonna steal it from him.
Right, and break a million copyright laws in order to do so.
Yeah, and, you know, on the one hand, he will never make a profit from this movie, but, you know, he's achieved something greater.